history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are individuals where you live with some stories to tell. Sometimes it's just a matter of taking the time to listen, and that's what we do here on this program. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And boy, what things we learn. We are educated or entertained and inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. As we mark Memorial Day weekend, we're going to hear the story of two brothers. They both served in World War II and both came home from that war. One of them had to go to Korea and never did come back. We'll hear from the surviving brother, Doug Justice of Visalia, California. He's 90 years old now.
You're born in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
Family of 8 kids.
Right. 5 girls, 3 boys.
So you guys were outnumbered.
Yeah.
Did you have to fight for dinner?
No. When they sat down at the table, you couldn't just get all you wanted. Yeah. In fact, actually, Mom would serve you, really, because it had to go around.
But you were pretty young. You were just 4 years old when your family packed things up and moved out to California?
Yeah, that was everything closed down, you know.
Because of the onset of the Depression.
Yeah.
The stock market crash in 29 and all of that.
Exactly. Everything closed down. Indiana had a lot of factories, you know, and it shut down. And then the school was cut back real big on people's wages and things, you know, trying to keep their head above water.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad went to work for a club down there for people that had the means to belong to these big clubs.
Mm.
He went to work for them and was a chef there for...
He had been working at Purdue University?
Yeah, he had been doing their diet stuff for the athletes.
Uh-huh. He has to come all the way out to California for work. What was that like for you as a kid to grow up in Southern California before it was a house at every 10 feet?
Well, where we lived in Monrovia, we're kind of up. You could kind of look out over the city a little bit. You could see, you know, most of it was, you know, orange groves and avocados and things like that. And then, of course, the observatory was there close to us, and we'd walk over there as kids or ride our bikes. That was a big thing for us.
How about the Rose Parade?
Rose Parade, yes. I'd like to have some pictures to show you. What my folks would, we walked there. It was that close.
Uh-huh.
And my dad would go down there early and put a mattress down on the sidewalk, you know. And then we'd all go down there and sit on this mattress and cover up with blankets and stuff. And you had to get there early, you know.
Uh-huh.
And watch the Rose Parade. That was a big thing for us, you know.
How about the game itself? Did you ever see some of those Rose Bowl games?
Yes, I can tell you that. I've seen a lot of those, and a lot at the Coliseum. Of course, from Indiana, I was a Notre Dame follower. Every time they came to play at USC, I was definitely go there. But I never paid for a ticket in my life. I always snuck in.
Did your brother Bert teach you that or what?
No, Bert was a lot more reserved than me.
You were the troublemaker.
I was the one that the teacher said, well, you're a good boy, but you'll never set the world on fire. I always had a good like for people. I didn't know much about anything else, but I did like people.
You're talking about the Rose Parade and the Rose Bowl, and I'm doing the math here. Weren't the Olympics in L.A. in 32?
Yep.
You would have been 7 years old, six,
yeah.
7 years old. Did you catch any of that?
No. You know, you had a little radio.
Uh-huh.
There was no television on like that. You just had a little radio, and you'd sit around it in the evenings and listen to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The broadcasting. It was good. My father followed boxing. Whether you liked it or not, you listened to it. Joe Louis was fighting Smelling and Jeff from Germany and all that thing, and country against country thing, you know.
Yeah, so you were into it. You felt
yeah.
The
yeah, I felt the whole thing. And like, you know, when we got there, there was no work. My dad, being a chef, and he made donuts in our house there, and my brother and I would go out and walk up and down the street and try to sell them.
How much would you sell a donut for?
Oh, I know, 3 cents.
3 cents for a donut.
And you'd be surprised, the nice homes there in Pasadena and Monrovia. You go up and knock on the door, and a person comes to the door, and can I just buy one? Yeah, you can just buy one. And things like that, you know, they're going their door, and their house was bare, no furniture. It was that, you know, strict.
And that's a picture of the Depression.
That's the picture.
That they've got this big fancy house that looks luxurious on the outside, but it's empty inside.
Empty inside.
Wow.
And so we did that. And then my dad found us some skates at this house we rented. And he took a board and put the skates on the bottom of the board and then put a box on that and a rope. And my brother and I would go down to the train station. And when the trains come in with the produce and stuff, that was stevedore, they'd throw it out of the carts onto the dock.
Right.
And the guys that worked in the warehouse would bring out their dollies and take it in. They got all done, and they'd say, okay, kids, clean it up. Well, all the things come in slatted crates.
Right.
Well, a carrot would fall out or a beet or something would fall out. Well, the guys said, okay, clean it up, kids. We'd throw that stuff in our trailer, and we'd go home, Mom would make soup.
Mm-hmm. So you're getting the leftovers. You're getting the dregs.
Yeah, and that was really neat. It's just those kind of things that I remember as a kid.
Was that kind of like a treasure hunt for you?
It was exciting, you know, to think that was the day we're going to go down when the vessels came in. All those little things like that, you know. I stood in with my mother. She was embarrassed, of course, and I wasn't embarrassed. I thought it was a great deal to stand in the line to get a loaf of bread and a soup in your little kettle you had.
Is that something that at the time wasn't a big deal to you, but now with all the life you've lived since then, you look back and say, boy, those were tough times.
Well, as a little kid, you know, you don't understand that what your parents are going through. And with that many kids, too, you know, you had a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
And of course, Dad would get up daylight and go out and pound the streets for a job, you know. I mean, I didn't realize we were that poor or had nothing. I had no idea.
Tell me about your brother, Bert. I mean, he was 4.5 years older than you. Was he showing you the ropes a little bit? Were you watching him? Were you guys close? Did you squabble? What was it like?
Well, yeah, we kind of growed up together, you know. Him taking the lead, like going getting them vegetables down at the dock. My mom wouldn't let me go by myself. And he took charge of that kind of leader for me and my younger brother and sister. They were twins. And my mother had twins at 42 years old there.
Oof.
And anyway, he was my idol, like, you know.
You looked up to him.
Yeah, I did. I did look up to Bert. He was really nice. He guided me through a lot as I screwed up. But, of course, he was that older, and he was, you know, going to school. And he graduated from high school, Bell, California, Bell High School. Of course, there wasn't a work. And then my folks rented a big old farmhouse out on Long Beach Boulevard and started a chicken dinner house.
Huh.
So we all worked, and my mother planted the berry vines to make the pies and kill their own chickens, you know, things like that for the dinner house.
What was your job?
My job was with Bert. We'd go out and cut the chickens' heads off. He did one by one. Well, he made a guillotine that just stick like six chickens' head through there, and you know, and that kind of stuff. He was always that way. We did good. We had a good life there, and folks did pretty good at the restaurant.
What was it called, the restaurant?
The Chicory.
On Long Beach Boulevard, you said.
There was 10 acres there. And the only people that ate in the restaurant was what really helped them was the people that had means and money would go to Long Beach Harbor and with their boats or yachts and things, you know. It got kind of well known. Mm-hmm. They would tell their friends and so forth. The first customer that I can remember was Randolph Scott.
Movie star.
Yeah. Uh-huh. He's going down there, and he stopped and had a dinner at my place, at my folks' place. He pulls up in there, and not my youngest, Alberta, she was probably 26 or something. Anyway, she was waiting tables. He pulls up in there, and he had this powder blue Lincoln Continental. She said, oh, what a pretty car. She waited on everything. He got ready to go and pay his bill. He said, would you like to take a ride? So he took her around in that car. Then on, you know, he told his friends, and then we had a lot of them come through there.
All the Hollywood stars were eating at the Chicory.
We had not all of them, but there was, you know, like James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart. There was two or three more. And they'd stop on their way back from their yachting, you know, and that kind of thing. And it was good. But then some doctor bought that 10 acres, and he had a good reason because he sold it to Sears and Roebuck, and they built a big store there.
So that put you guys out of business.
It put us out of business. I did a lot of work in that 10 acres when we were there, my brother and I. The man would cut the hay. My brother and I, when it dried, would load his wagon. My brother was taller and bigger than me, so he'd pitch it up there, and then I would stomp it down and that kind of stuff. And we got, you know, paid for it.
Yeah.
You know, not much, but something.
So you and your brother were quite a team. Sounds like you did a lot of things together.
Yeah, we did. We really did. He and I were decided we wanted to go to the beach. Mom fixed us a little sack lunch. We went out. We hitchhiked down the highway to Atlantic Boulevard, I believe. And we hitchhiked down Atlantic Boulevard to the beach. Went and played all day and stashed our clothes on it by the pier underneath some stuff there, and somebody took them.
Uh-oh.
We're in our bathing suits, barefooted, trying to get home. And lucked out, people did pick us up.
Glad you didn't have scalded soles there
We had some hot feet.
I bet you did.
On that concrete.
Did Bert go into the service before Pearl Harbor?
Bert went in the service in 39.
What was that like for you? Was that kind of hard to see him gone?
Oh, yeah. You know, he was my big brother, and boy, he's going to be an Army man. And he went, and it wasn't a work. So you either did that or you couldn't do it, you know, and he wanted to work. And so he went in the Army in 39, and they sent him back to Fort Benning, and they made a first lieutenant out of him.
Mm-hmm.
And artillery. So he was, you know, in there before. Well, of course, Hitler was carrying on over there.
But America wasn't in the war yet.
Nope.
Until the day that all changed. And yeah. I bet you remember something about December 7th, 1941.
Well, yeah. You know, it was amazing. It was a big thing. The Japanese had been fighting wars for 20 years. They had a big army. They mm-hmm. were well equipped. And we didn't have beans, you know.
And you're 16 years old.
Uh-huh.
What do you remember about that Sunday? I bet you guys went to church.
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. We always went to church. There was no doubt about that. There was no doubt about that. Of course, you know, Bert then was been in the service, so that got jacked up and, you know, more activity and things going on. He was stationed in artillery in San Luis Obispo. I had a little 1930 Ford coupe. And so my mother wanted to go see him. So we got in that little car and drove to San Luis Obispo. So that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove there and seen Bert and visited with him and left home. That's when I first seen him in a real uniform, you know. And then I got in the service in 43.
Let me ask you something first, because I've heard some stories from folks who lived in Southern California during this time.
Uh-huh.
That right after Pearl Harbor, life in the L.A. area changed quite a bit. You guys had to black out your lights and everything?
My dad was a warden, and he had a certain many blocks to cover,
mm-hmm.
and he had a hat on and a flashlight.
So he had to enforce the curfew, make sure nobody's out there?
Yeah, he'd go if their lights were on, he'd tap on the door with his stick and say, hey, pull your shades down there, whatever, you know, that kind of stuff.
Were you afraid the Japanese were going to attack L.A.?
Well, you know, not afraid because I wasn't old enough to be afraid. But there was a lot of concern with the older people because we had a lot of Japanese there. Every fruit that you bought was from the Japanese gardens there.
Yeah.
They all had Japanese, the gardens, of all the vegetables and stuff.
And the old 9th Street Market, did you used to go down there?
Yep. And Alavetta Street and all those kind of things. But that was a thing because the Japanese man had this garden out, 20 acres or whatever, and he had a big pond on it. We'd go out there and swim in it. He let us come swim.
Mm-hmm.
And so, a very nice man. And then all of a sudden, he's gone, and his family's gone, and his garden's gone. And it was really not very nice. You know?
Yeah.
It wasn't nice because they were good people.
What made you decide to get into the service? Or did they decide for you?
Yeah. I come home, and my mother says, you have a letter from the War Department. 18 years old. I never knew nothing about bad stuff. So time for me to go. And my mother walked me down to the red car at Mom's put me some clean underwear in there. So, you know, I said, Mom, I don't think, you know, oh, yeah, you have to do this. Be, no. And then she'd tell me all the things. Now, be yourself. You know right from wrong. You know, and told me all this stuff. And she was walked me to the red car line, had still her apron on, and goodbye.
What was the biggest adjustment you had to make? What was the hardest thing to get used to?
I think the hardest thing was losing my contact with my parents and my friends.
So where was Bert this whole time?
He was in Europe, and that's where they sent him, because the artillery, you know, big time mm-hmm. over there. He went through the whole shebang for as long as it lasted.
Were you hoping you could end up where he was?
No, you know, I didn't. I didn't think about it. But the time that I went in, the Japanese were just killing us. We didn't have anything out there to protect them. You know, they still had World War I's equipment, guns and stuff, you know, no automatic stuff, anything, you know. And so they were just running right over the top of us because there was nothing out there to stop them. And so they were really, really needing boots on the ground.
Army needed bodies, and they needed them now.
And they needed them now.
Yeah.
So I went through my basic training
at
Camp Roberts. When I finished my basic training, the lieutenant that was in charge of our company there come to me and a kid named Bob Simone. You guys ought to sign up for this new thing they're starting. Going to be a special team or something. And so, oh, yeah, we'll do that, you know. Got into this unit, and when they were in sand dunes over there on the coast, and we trained in that sand, went in the ocean with rafts and tried to sneak on shore and not be seen, all that kind of stuff. A lot of fun kid play, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then they they were going to form a glider.
Glider thing. Infantry?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, it didn't work. They didn't have enough big open spots where we were training. Kids are flying those things, you know, or you hit the ground and it didn't last, you know. They're killing too many guys, you know.
Just in training. Mm.
You know, the one I was in, they had that little 37 whatever meter cannon and it broke loose and just killed a young kid that was flying that thing.
You were in the glider?
Yeah.
You're in a glider. And they've got a cannon that they're going to take in the glider, and then you land and you bust out the cannon.
Yeah, you're supposed to get the cannon out and set up. And anyway.
So another guy on the glider you're on gets killed in training.
Yeah, he got killed.
Did that make you think you're doing something dangerous?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, but I really didn't ever think about dying or I didn't never entered my mind. That was probably the first guy I seen, you know, get killed. So we did all that kind of training, and then they sent us to Camp Stillman up in San Francisco area.
Mm-hmm.
And we started jumping off the towers, low parachute stuff, never in an airplane. We jumped and we jumped and we trained and we trained and we jumped and we trained. Our captain was a nice man, young, strong, you know, after we'd been training for a month or two, I'd go into his office every Friday and I'd ask for a pass to go home to see my family. Nope, we may be going out here any day.
Hmm.
Nope, can't go now. And I went in this time, and I walked in the door, and he looked up, and he said, blinkety blank, justice, here, go see your parents. He gave me the pass. I ran out that gate. I got on that milk train. You know, I just barely got home in time to say, hi, Mom and Dad, and run back and try to get home. And I came back, and I ran real, because I was going to be late, and I ran back, and I ran through the gate, and the guard said, hey, ho, ho, no, I just kept running. And I ran to our barracks. Everything was gone. All the cots were rolled up, you know, except mine. I said, what the heck? So I ran to the headquarters there, asked them about it. Well, they're shipping out. I said, well, where are they? Well, they're down on the dock. So I just take off running down, and there they are, loading all these trucks, taking them to the docks, you know, to ship them off. And I come up to my lieutenant that I was in. I didn't get to see my captain. But I was coming to the lieutenant, you know, I said, hey, he says, you can't go. I said, what do you mean I can't go? I'm here and I am going. No, you can't. You're not coded. So they took off and left me there. So I stayed there by myself for, I don't know, a month. I just played basketball every day, shot loops, just that kind of stuff to kill my time. Slept in the barracks all by myself. One day a lieutenant was going by and he come over to me. He says, what's your outfit? And I said, well, they left her over there. He said, what are you doing all day? I said, I'm just hanging around here, going to the chow when it was time in somebody's chow and that kind of stuff. And so 81st came in from Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. That's how you ended up in the 81st Infantry Division.
Exactly.
But I know everybody listening is saying, well, what about those other guys? If you hadn't gone home to see your parents and you had been shipped out with that other group, where did they go and what happened to them?
My only thinking, I can prove it or nothing, they were a decoy for MacArthur coming back to the Philippines. As far as all I know, I looked and tried to find in the Stars and Stripes, I know everything to see what happened to him. What I had heard, and they went to Manila and did a low jump, and they got slaughtered. Bob, my friend I was telling you about, was from me and another boy. I don't know how what the answer to those mothers and fathers. Both of those boys' mothers would call me and write me letters and say, what happened to my son? What happened to this? And I wasn't there to tell them nothing. But I think that that was their mission that they'd been training for all that time.
Do you know what the unit was called? Or?
We had none. We had no patches. We had nothing. And so I don't know what that was.
The most you ever heard was that they jumped behind enemy lines in the Philippines.
Yep.
Ahead of the lady landings.
Yeah. That's the stuff you heard. You know.
So the implication is, had you not gotten that pass to go see your parents,
I wouldn't have been here.
You would have been killed in that jump.
Absolutely.
There's no doubt in your mind.
No doubt in my mind. I would have been killed because there was no survivors. You know, I'm sure some of them got captured, but there was no survivors that I ever heard of.
This was a pretty small unit?
There was probably 300-400 guys.
Really?
Yeah. That was tough.
I'll say, but tougher times were still to come for Doug Justice in World War II. We're going to hear about that. And also his older brother, Bert, and the unique way Doug got to honor Bert's legacy through the Honor Flight program. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 90-year-old Doug Justice of Visalia, California. He served with the 81st Infantry Division in the Pacific during World War II, and here are the first words he heard after arriving overseas in New Caledonia.
You guys in the first line here, follow me. Leave your bags right here. Okay, we went. Got over there, and they had tarps with ropes stretched between the coconut trees, you know, the big trees. Our duty that he gave us was going through the pockets and all those kids that were dead and taking their stuff and putting it in a little rubberized bag. Anyway, that was my first thing of seeing all those young guys that's no arms, face, all no feet, you know, just terrible stuff.
And you're just a teenager.
Yeah, 18 years old.
Did that make you sick to your stomach?
Well, it was very bad. Yeah, it was really bad. A lot of guys throwed up, and I cried like heck, but I didn't get sick at my stomach.
Welcome to the war.
Yeah, and so that was my introduced to the war.
In those moments, as you're seeing all these guys who are just like you.
Yeah.
I mean, they're teenagers too.
A lot of them tiny.
And they're gone.
Young guys, they're gone.
Is there part of you that says, hey, that could be me, that could be my brother?
Well, I didn't think about it that way. My first reaction was to, after I got done with all that problem, the next time I got kind of by myself, not by myself, you never were by yourself hardly, but where I could still think about it as how useless. I just felt, why can't they settle things with, you know, that was my feelings. And then I growed with that outfit a little bit and went on, and it's like all the other guys, and did our thing. Actually, the thing that bothered me the most is the guys that, not that time, another time, I don't know what island it was on, burying those guys. You know, you'd go out and you'd dig the trenches. Then you'd go out there when you're trying to bury him, and there'd be a guy laying there on both sides of him. And he'd be wrapped up in a blanket. And they'd play taps, does that, and you pull the blanket and they roll in the holes. That bothered me worse than anything. Mm. That was hard. And I got to know the guys, but after I got to being in charge of other guys, you got to help them, charge of them, and you want to do the right thing. That was bad.
You feel responsible for whether or not they live?
Yeah. You feel responsible for them. Mm-hmm. And you know them. You've talked to them. Oh, they come from this place. And my dad and mom and my brother and sisters or my girlfriend or whatever. You know, and you get to know them. So it didn't take me long to find out I didn't want to know them. I wanted to know their name.
And that was it.
Jackson. Get up, Jackson, Pete, or whatever. Because, you know, you go out and you do your thing. You come back and some of them are gone already.
Well, and that's just it. Mathematically, you know you're going to lose a lot of these guys.
Yeah. Well, when we were training to go to Japan, they told us it would be, you know, 70% kill.
If you made the eventual invasion of mainland Japan.
Yeah.
Right. But even in the battles you were in, there were losses. You were at Peleliu, Philippines, Okinawa.
Well, you know, and what bothers me most, Paul, is I don't know how I got to these places.
You remember some of the incidents, but you don't remember showing up on those islands?
Nope. I remember on the hatch, the pastor, the minister there was, you know, telling us God be with you and give you strength and all this kind of stuff, you know, saying some of you are not going to come back and told us that stuff. I remember that part. And I remember going over to the side on those boats, you know, those nets they hang down. You go on those nets and you got everything you own on you. And the waves come, you swing out 15, 20 feet.
Yeah.
Goes the other way, wham! And you're trying to hang on to these ropes. You know how many guys went right there?
Went straight down.
Straight down. They lost their...
Lost all their stuff?
Yep. Dropped their grips. Lost their stuff. That kind of stuff, you know, you get really... But I never thought I would die. I never thought about I would be dead. Never did I.
I bet you got shot at a little bit.
Well, I never got hit. I got hurt. A few times. The one time I got hurt, what my squad was going to do, I've been told. Of course, in them days, you know, aerial photos didn't show any elevation. So you looked at it and said, oh, that's easy. That's just flat beach right up to the jungle.
Right.
Get there and there'd be a 30-foot cliff up there.
Oof.
You thought, oh, you got it all planned out.
Until you get there.
Totally chaos.
So you said, so your squad, you knew what your objective was.
Yeah, I was supposed to go to the left. They would know you're coming, of course, and them islands, a lot of them have been Jap-mandated for hundreds of years. And so they had these pillboxes or however big the beach was or whatever it was, and so they'd crossfire. And they already knew exactly at the exact range that you were at.
They knew where you guys were going and had it zeroed in and could pick you off.
Yeah, their mortars, they had practiced and they knew how they put much emigrants you put in that tube and they all knew that stuff. So the thing went down, I ran off to the side, I have to take all the ammunition you can carry and then I had a 30 caliber machine gun on my shoulder and the thing went down, then I don't know what happened. I have no idea. Next I know a guy hollers, hey, here's a guy over here. I'm laying there. I remember trying to get the sand out of my eyes and my mouth and stuff. And I'm laying there, and this guy runs up to me, hollers back to the coxswain that just came in with a load of supplies. And he says, there's a guy over here. So he took me over there, and I had a tag on me. Some medic had tagged me, and they gave me painkiller, morphine, or whatever he did. And then I went on the boat, and they took me. I never tell this story much because people think you're stupid or something, but these guys put me up in front of the windshield on this boat, Higgins, I believe they call them.
The LCVPs?
Yeah. They set me up on the top.
Uh-huh.
And they backed out, made a big turn, because I was, you know, all...
You're out of it.
Yeah, I was out of it. And I slid off into the water. They were going.
They kept going?
Well, they did. And the coxswain was going. And the other guy, because there's always two guys on those, hollered, and I was just bobbing in there. And he hollered at him, turn around, I can get him. I can get him. Turn around. He turned around and come by and they have a pole on those things. He hooked me up and pulled me in, and there was a Navy hospital ship out there. Thing and put me up the side, and I wasn't shot or nothing. I had this arm, instead of being this way, it was going that way.
You dislocated your elbow or something?
Yeah, and I didn't know what happened to the. There was something else that was wrong. But anyway, they put him up there, and I stayed there for, I don't know how long, 10 days, as soon as they got a hospital on the land, you know, take over some building or something. And so they got that, then they sent me over there.
And you don't know what happened. You just remember the door flipping down and you going out, and then the next thing you do, you're waking up because they found you.
Yeah,
because
when I went down, I remember going up in the air, and I had this stuff on, and I put this arm down to brace the fall, and I guess that's when it popped out or whatever.
So maybe there was further to go from that door than you thought there was.
Huh? Probably. Could be. You get out on there, and you got to be careful because you're landing that thing, and if they don't go in far enough, some of them get kind of scared, you know. And they don't go in far enough to let that come down where they hit the ground. The wave comes, and that thing goes like that. It'll throw you whichever way. So I don't know if that's what happened. When I woke up, all my ammunition was gone, and gun thing was gone, and there was nothing there.
And nobody ever told you later? Nobody that was with you or anything?
No.
So how long were you out of commission?
Oh, I was out for quite a little while. My arm had swollen up huge. And the doctor come in, it was a colonel, and he looked at my arm, and he says, well, we'll put a tin on it, the heat. The arm is just huge. And it starts smelling. And you could actually take my fingers and go like that and just dig out the flesh, and it was just mush.
Ugh.
You know, and it was very, smelled like terrible. So I'm laying there in this hospital, and this little Japanese lady came down there, and she says to me, wanted to know if that guy down there that was cleaning and stuff could look at my arm, Japanese man. And I said, sure. So he came down, took off the thing, and he looked at my arm. He started right here.
Started by your wrist?
To find the first cord or whatever you want there in my wrist, nerve or whatever. He'd start with his thumb, and he'd work it up till he lost it, and he'd go back. He did that probably for 10 minutes, whatever. Put the thing back on, leave.
Bowed to you and left. Yeah.
Goes on like that for, he was working on me probably 4 days. And the doctor comes in. He looked at it. My arm was going down. Still smelled terrible, but it was going down. He says, well, he says, I see that's working. And I said, no, sir. I says, see that guy you got cleaning the toilets? He was a doctor. I says, he's the one who fixed my arm. He gave me the dirtiest look you ever seen in your whole life. Walked out, and I never seen him again.
Mm.
But that little Japanese guy is the one who fixed this arm. That big colonel guy said, your arm will always be, you'll never be able to straighten your arm, he told me. I don't know if I should be telling you all this dumb stuff, but when I was a young boy living on that 10 acres, and my nephew and I, Tommy, played in the barn and playing at that, and he fell out, tore up this arm.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't go to the doctors. My mother straightened it out, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
She took her big old flat iron, you sit on the stove.
Yeah.
And made him carry it.
Uh-huh.
Because his arm was like that when he got out of the sling.
So his was bent at the elbow, and she straightened it out by having him carry the weight around.
I got out of that hospital, and I was trying to find my unit.
Yeah.
I was just walking.
Right.
And I come along with a big hunk of rock laying in the road.
Uh-huh.
I picked it up. I carried it till somebody told me, well, you're up, it's on the end of the aisle or whatever it was. And I go there. They sent me to the medic, and he looked at me. What are you carrying the rock for? I told him. So he took some gauze and put it in there so it stayed there.
Yeah.
And I carried that sucker around until that arm was like that.
You carried the rock until your arm was straight?
Yep.
I love it. That's great.
So those are little things that, you know, have. I did probably 100,000 guys had more things to do than me, but that was my own little experiences.
And who knows, maybe that time out of combat saved your life again. I mean, you don't get sent over with those paratroopers, and now here's a situation where you're hurt coming out of the boat.
Well, I had three times, I'll tell you, Paul, I had three times that absolutely truthful in my own heart, I knew God had a plan for me. Because missing that trip with all those guys I'd trained with, all good friends now, getting home, gone. I went to these other guys. The theory was that the Marines came and landed on Peleliu. We are here as their backup.
Right.
The commander of our troops on our boat and the commander on the Marines' boat. And you could see what was happening. And I could hear the voice. The commander of our boat was hollering to him, "Do you want us to move in? Do you want us to move in? No, we got it. We got it. We're no end." That kind of stuff. A lot of crap in that service. One wants to be the best.
Yep.
And anyway.
And with that battle in particular, it's well documented that the bravado of the Marine Corps, Chesty Puller, and the Marines hurt the chances of winning that battle quicker and cost a lot of guys their lives because they didn't bring you Army guys in sooner.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There was Japanese mowed them down like crazy.
On that island, it was rough.
It was tough one. So we ended up cleaning up a little bit, and then they wanted Angar because it's flat.
Right.
It was all coil.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted it for an airfield. So then we went there and got that. That's where our captain... Captain Talmage from New York. There wasn't a lot of trees on that island. It's all coil. Well, up high on the highland ground was these rocks and things up there.
Yeah.
Unbeknown to us, there was caves on that whole thing. And so to let the engineers come and start the airport, we had to get rid of those guys up there because they had, we found out later, but we thought they had a whole bunch of those 77 millimeter cannons, the small ones.
Yeah.
And they could shoot from up there. So they'd shoot, want to go off over here, and a little while left, they'd go off over here. After we found out and got in there, they had a little track, and they pushed this thing from place to place.
Yeah, it was on train tracks.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they'd push it from place to place.
Yeah.
And so that's when we had to go up there and get them out. So that's where we were going up there, and Captain Tolley come by me, and he said something to me. I think I got in behind a big coil rock or something. I could hear the bullets, you know, ding, ding. And if you ever hear a pop air by you, you know. But anyway, and he said, "Just that you can't win the war behind the rock." And I said, "Yes, sir." So he took off. And so I got myself up, and I was ready to go follow him, and I heard him hollering. I said, "Oh, man." You know, and so I stopped, got myself back off under that rock, and I moved over to the right, and there was a kind of a big, where the coil head came about like a half moon and up and around, and I got there. So now I'm sitting there thinking, what the heck? You know, I ain't going out there because that was their whole thing. They'd shoot somebody. I went in, he squalled. Another guy goes out there and they kill him.
When you say you heard him hollering, you're thinking he just got killed.
Well, yeah, I thought so. Yeah. But he was hollering, so I knew he was still. I sat for, I don't know how long, probably seconds, but so I said, how do I get out of here? So I move around this coil, and I go this way, and there's kind of in between little place. I could squirm around through there, and I got out of there, and I'm trying to see out across that field because we were down here in the depths are up there, trying to find out where that fire was coming from. And I get over there a little ways, and I had to move a couple of times, and I seen two guys up on the coil up there, and they had a machine gun. One was shooting, and the other was loading the bullets, you know, holding the belt.
You could see the loader, but not the gunner.
I could see the loader.
Yeah.
And so I whacked him one, and he went down. Then the guy that was shooting the gun got up to run. I was able to get him, too. That stopped all that crossfire on that ridge. That was something. Well, anyway, Thomas, I got to him, and I put some sulfur in his wounds, his legs. And after that thing was over, I don't know, it was a couple of days or whatever it was, I went back. And, of course, if you've ever been in that, they got tent of wounded.
Right.
All lined up. So I went back. I'm walking up and down these aisles to find him. And I find him, and he's laying in his cot. He said, "Well, just as I get to go home." I said, "You're faking it, you know." And anyway, we talked and visited for a while. I was sitting on the edge of his bed. In come two lieutenants, fresh from school. They had on white leggings, gloves, just like they did when they were in their academy.
Yeah.
And they come in, and they looked up, and they saluted him, and I saluted them. They were questioning him, and he was telling them the situations that he had seen so far and all this kind of stuff. After quite a little while, he says, "You guys, watch this kid." He says, "If you want to go home, tell you what he tells you." Yeah. Of course, they want this kid to tell me nothing for. But anyway, it turned out they were good guys. And we made it through there. Finally got up to those holes. Finally got up there. The biggest thing that helped us was their bonsai charges at just before dark. They would come and then it hit the ground and filter through, you know. Because
yeah.
I knew that place, that was their home.
Right.
But the flamethrowers were the absolutely answer to stop that. We'd get a flamethrower, and they'd bring them to us at dark or before dark, and we had two. When they'd start coming down, then you could just light up the whole thing. And that's one thing they didn't like is the fire. You could shoot them a dozen times, and they still kept coming with that sake in them. So that stopped that. That stopped that thing. And then we got up to the cliff and found out, like, almost caves and stuff. It was a kind of a neat battle, really. I mean, it wasn't big, enormous, or nothing like that. But it was just a concentrated stronghold for them.
It would have been big enough to take your life.
Oh, a lot of guys didn't make it, but I came out of that fine. I didn't get hurt or nothing. We secured the island. The guys made the airstrip, and we stayed there for I don't know how long we stayed there.
But that was another time where you felt somebody was looking out for you.
I tell you what, that was it. That was the whole unbelievable stuff to me. I just can't hardly imagine that what God had planned for me, because I can't even think about it. But what? That was a good life. I wouldn't want to do it again.
Yeah.
No, but I growed up. Like my mother says, you win when 18, come back at 40.
Well, what was it like to come back? What did that mean to you?
Well, things that you can't imagine that happened, Paul. We left at Japan on Admiral Capps. It's a big ship.
Yeah.
Two-stacker. 5,000 troops and plus the crew. We left Japan to come to San Francisco. We got in a storm where we were stayed up all night, all day, with the coxswain standing in front of us in our holds, telling us which way to go so the boat wouldn't turn over. And he'd this way, and we'd all go that way, and then we'd go this way. We ended up in Seattle. That's where that thing ended up, in Seattle. That's where I got discharged from, instead of San Francisco. And I got home. I can't tell you how I got home from Seattle, but I got home, come in a taxi to my house. And it was, I would say, probably 4 o'clock in the morning when I got there. And I got out and I stepped out on the ground and I looked around. It was different. I got back in the cab with 1 foot still on the ground. And here come my mother out the door onto the porch. Then I was okay. I went in. And it was good. My folks and my kid, brothers and sisters were super to me. They really were super. They helped me a lot.
But what about that big brother, Bert? That's a story that was pretty murky until the last few years. The details that Doug has found since and the way he got to honor his late brother in Washington, D.C. All of that and more when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We've heard from 90-year-old Doug Justice of Visalia, California, about some of his own close calls during World War II. But what about the older brother he always looked up to? What happened to Bert Justice after the war?
He got back before I did, and he was starting his family, you know. And they had 3 young bang, 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 because he got called back in the service in the 50. I don't think he was in Korea, but about maybe 2-3 months before he got.
Well, let me ask this. After you guys were both from the war, here you'd been in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. He'd been in Europe, two very different wars. Mm. Did you guys ever talk about it with each other?
No. We never did, really. He'd stop by after work, and we'd sit there and on the porch and just talk about life and about this and that. But the war business, letters he wrote me told me something, what was happening to him. The last couple letters I got, he was in Korea, and he said, I don't know what's happened. He said, we've been on a train ride for all night. We got to this place, got set up, he says, and then that morning, we had to go up this hill and see if it was clear. And so we went up and looked around, it was all, there was no enemies, and everything looked good. So we came back down. We did that twice, he says. And the third time, volunteer Chinese army got in there, whole hundreds of them, said slaughtered all of them, 229 guys.
So the same spot they'd been to twice before.
Same spot.
And he writes in the letter, we're going to go up there a third time.
Yeah, exactly.
And that third time was when he and all these guys got wiped out.
Yeah. Exactly.
And his body's never been recovered.
We could find his body, but they won't let us in.
Because just in recent years, you've learned quite a few more details about what happened to your brother by connecting with a researcher who has helped the families of quite a few Korean War POWs.
Mr. Ryan says, when the guys that came across, you were too young, but they had a bridge. We'd trade one prisoner for prisoner.
Yeah.
I remember sitting there with my mom and dad, looking at that little television about as big as this thing, and watching them come across. Calling their names. Of course, we were waiting for my brother. Didn't show up. But Mr. Bryan says, I've interviewed three guys that knew your brother that made that clear up and back. And he says, they knew your brother. He marched with us. They marched a long way, you know, and they could only march at night because of the airplanes. The American would spot them.
Right.
And so they marched these prisoners wherever. Mr. Bryan says that this man told him, your brother was shot in the leg and he had a broken arm. The leg was pretty bad shape, but they marched. They must have walked 110, 15, 20 miles.
And your brother marched all that way?
All that way. And he says, the guys I interviewed says they got to this kind of a little hamlet or something. They stayed there during the day. They said he never came out. We didn't see him after that.
After one long day of marching, he never woke up the next day.
Yeah. After that, they don't know what happened to him, you know. They told Mr. Bryan that being an officer, they didn't treat him too well, wanting information. He said, your brother, they liked your brother, and he was a good guy and all that stuff. And they said, but if they give us permission to go in there, we'll find him. They know where how far those guys said they got to this certain spot.
Yeah.
And he said, that's the last time we seen him. He said, if we got in there, I'm sure that we could get his remains.
Is that important to you?
No, not really. I had to come thing with it, you know, for a few years there. But
well, and let's go back, because you guys have both made it through World War II, and I'm sure he had as many close calls in World War II as you did. He was in from before the war started.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
And then here he's got a wife and three kids.
Yeah.
And he has to go back over to Korea. Mm-hmm. Was that hard for you, knowing that he was going?
Well, my first thought was that he ought to put hardship thing.
Try to get out of it.
Try to get out of it. But knowing him, he wouldn't do that. He wouldn't do that. It's his duty.
And even in your description of him as a kid, it sounds like he always had that drive to do things the way they were supposed to be done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everything had to be perfect. You know, one of those kind of guys.
So then he's over there in Korea, and you know how dangerous it is. You've been through combat. You're getting letters from him. And then what? You guys get a telegram that he's missing?
That when he left, he had bought a house. And so my mom and dad went to his house and stayed there to take care of the kids while the wife worked. And they were there. Somebody came to the door, wanted to talk to Grace because she wasn't even there. But it's your son. He's missing.
So then you're talking about watching the television. You guys don't know if he's alive or dead or anything.
Nope.
And probably didn't know for a long time.
Didn't know. Didn't know.
You're talking about the details you have now. When did you get those details?
Well, Mr. O'Brien gave them to me 2 years ago.
For more than 60 years, you didn't know if he was killed in action, survived, was a prisoner. You didn't know any of that?
No, didn't know anything.
When you finally found out those details, that he was wounded, that he was captured, that he marched over 100 miles and then died there, what did that mean to you?
Of course, I didn't know he was wounded. I didn't know that. I knew if he was just captured, I know he's strong and he'd do his very best to get through and get home. But I didn't know all that other stuff. And his wife, Grace, didn't know it either. And so he's just missing. And so we didn't know it. I didn't know he was hurt. And then when I came to Mr. O'Brien, boy, that was a shock.
I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know that I have an answer or that it's easy to answer, but I'm thinking of your own story. You know, you said there were those three times where it was really clear to you that God had a plan for you. And then you think about your brother and everything he gets through in World War II. Mm-hmm. And then he dies in Korea and leaves behind a wife and three kids. Mm-hmm. Is that hard for you to... Did that make you angry with God? Or how do you stomach that one?
Well, no, I didn't get mad at him. I reasoned why, you know, because I know that if there's any chance at all, I know Bert would have came home.
So Memorial Day happens once a year.
Yep.
What do you think about on Memorial Day?
Well, you know, I tell you, Paul, when I came out, I really didn't want anything to do with any of it anymore.
And you didn't want to go on the honor flight?
No, I didn't. I thought, no, I said, I don't want to listen to all the stories. I don't want to do this. Everybody's got a story. And my daughter, the one that made this book, she just, Dad, you got to go. Dad, you got to go. Kept asking me. And finally, Tim says, Dad, I'll be your chaperone. So I, okay, so I went. But it was one of the best things I ever did. I'll have to tell you. It was one of the best things ending my lifetime now is, was just going there and looking at all those old wrinkled faces. And I thought to myself, no wonder we win the war. Those guys wouldn't give an inch. That's a fact.
And there was another one of those guys who wasn't on that trip with you, but you still got to give him your regards.
Oh, yeah.
At the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery, you got to go lay a wreath. And that tomb is for people like your brother.
Yeah.
Who've never been recovered.
That's exactly what I didn't think about that really, because I didn't think about putting the wreath on there. But then Al coming to me and asked me if I'd like to do that. And I was stunned. And I said, oh, God, I don't know how to do that. Or, you know, I don't know what I thought about. And my son said, Dad, you can do it. You got to do it. So I did. And as I walked up there, and you know how the process goes, all the Marine soldiers walking around, you know, gun clicking their heels and doing all that kind of stuff. I sat there and watched all that, and then I got up to go up there, and then I took it with them. We walked up like that, and I said, Bert, you're gone, but you're not forgotten.
You said that audibly.
Yeah, that was a good thing. That was a good.
What does Memorial Day mean to you?
Well, I've been a few times over to the cemetery, all the flags and stuff. I've been, you know, I listen to the speeches and say, I wonder if these guys really know what it was like. I said, I wonder if they even had any inclination. You know, people think of soldiers of getting wounded and shot and all this kind of stuff. They don't think of the wet clothes, wet feet for days, and then take your shoes off and you take your socks and the skin comes with it. And I always think, I wonder if they have any idea what it's like. And I just told those the other day, I was watching a golf, and these little Japanese and Korean girls playing golf. They're good. I told us, I says, I wonder if they know how many Americans died for that, what they're being able to do today. I wonder if they have any idea how many guys give their life so they can do what they're doing today. And I doubt it. I asked my grandkids, they said, well, studying Caesar, we're doing this. I said, you ever anything on World War II? No. These kids don't even know. They have no idea. I mean, come on. They got every kind of book and English, everything they do, but they don't have anything about that.
One thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a little bit about your story and your brother's story. Is there anything else you want to say about him? Is there a way that you hope people would remember your brother, Bert?
Well, the two older children, Patrick and Mary, remember their dad. The young one, Agnes, she says, I don't know nothing about him. What's that little girl missed in life? She don't even know that the feeling of a dad holding her and rocking her and jiggling her around. And kind of a lonesome thought for me at how a human being go through life and don't even know what her dad was or looked like even, except a picture.
There's a question for you. You think it made you a better dad to know that his kids didn't have their dad? Did it make you more intentional at what you were doing?
Yeah, it made me, in my lifetime, a working and get jobs where it took me away from home for a week or two at a time. Good jobs. I could have supported my family better, really. I'd turn them down. I wanted to be home at nights. And I loved kids. I just absolutely think that's the, if we just stop and watch them little things, and the world would should cure itself. Just watch them and feel them, and how innocent they are and how happy they are. Like I say, my kids don't know nothing. I didn't want to say things that people think, well, this guy is a goofball. I just didn't. And like about the times, I have three times in my life to where I just actually said out loud to myself, of course, God, I've did all I can. I can't do no more. So I need your help. I felt like we were going to get overrun. And I remember shooting. And my gun got so hot I couldn't hold it. And I dropped it. And there was a guy over here didn't need his anymore. So I used his. But I can remember saying at that time, I did all I can do. I don't know what to do next. So I need your help. What happened after that, I could no more tell you than the man on the moon. The next thing I know, I was off to a place where they had tables and chairs and eating when you wanted to and touch it like a king, had pajamas, and because I couldn't talk.
You couldn't talk?
I could see, I could hear, but I couldn't talk. They sent me this place and they kept me there for, I don't know how many, 6 weeks or whatever it was. And I was strong, so they sent me over to a naval warehouse to work. Coca-Cola come in 50-gallon drum, big drums, wood drums. And one of them had fell off a forklift and busted. And it lay there. Well, it was harder than this table. Only thing I could get it up was chip it up. And that's what my job was. He's standing with me and he's showing me, you know, this is the way you do it and stuff like that. Okay, I can hear it and I can see and all of that. A guy comes back in a forklift and he hollers this guy standing there. What are you talking to that dummy for? He can't even hear you.
He thought you were deaf, too?
Yeah, he thought I was dumb, deaf, you know. And I always remembered that.
Were you afraid that you were never going to be able to talk again?
Well, no, when they did that all that time, they had no reason. They said that I had seen something, did something, whatever, that it just shut down.
PTSD kind of stuff.
Yeah,
saying.
I think that was what they...
Yeah,
that's what it was. I was... and then I went back after that and carried on. But I don't know why that happened, because I wish I could remember, but I cannot. What happened to make me.
And maybe it's supposed to be that way.
Yeah.
Maybe you're not supposed to remember.
Yeah.
Well, we sure are thankful for the memories Mr. Justice did share with us today and the chance to honor the memory of his brother Bert this Memorial Day. Make sure you take that time out to reflect on the price that's been paid on our behalf. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.